Welcome to Regenerative Spaces, a podcast that explores holistic and sustainable paths toward thriving in the fields of agriculture, education, spirituality, and beyond. Hey there, and welcome to Regenerative Spaces. I'm your host, Stacy Pellice. I'm a regenerative farmer in Santa Barbara, California, but my background and interests span a much broader range of fields, from psychology to spirituality and beyond. In my 3+ decades as an environmental activist, author, and educator, I've gotten increasingly curious about the links between the various ecosystems humans occupy. On this podcast, I'm inviting you to get curious with me. These episodes feature approachable conversations with inspiring experts in different disciplines, from intuitive healers, nonprofit founders, activists, and educators. We'll cover county politics, cattle ranching, and a whole world of other specialties in between. These folks are all at the forefront of their chosen fields, and each one offers a unique perspective on holistic, sustainable, and regenerative possibilities for our individual and collective lives. Get ready for today's enlightening conversation with my dear friend, Patricia Selbert, who is not only a regenerative rancher, but also the co-founder and general manager of Las Cumbres Ranch, nestled on the central coast of California. Patricia and I first crossed paths over 2 decades ago through our children, and our bond has only grown stronger over the years, fueled by shared interests, hobbies, and life experiences. While our paths in holistic land management have been parallel, Patricia's has led her to specialize in breeding pedigree Bonsmara cattle. In today's discussion, we're diving deep into Patricia's journey, shedding light on ethical and sustainable practices in cattle farming that may challenge your conventional notions. Get ready to broaden your perspective as we learn about Patricia's innovative approach to ranching. Let's jump right in. Hi, Patricia. How are you today?
Hi, Stacy. I'm good. I'm really good.
I'm always so excited when we get time together. Never enough time with you. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. And I love spending time with you and talking.
Yeah. So let's share what you and I talk about, which I find so interesting. So I would love it if other people could kind of hear a little bit about what brought you to your current moment. I mean, obviously everything, but I find everybody's unique path ends up informing their special genius, and for which you are one of the geniuses in my life. You are a beacon of information and education and a beautiful, positive way to live life. So can you give a little background on how you got here in some way, even if it doesn't make sense?
So sweet. Thank you. And you've been a huge influence on my life too, first of all. So the feeling is mutual. Thank you. Let's see. Looking in retrospect, it makes a lot of sense. Coming forward from my life as I was going, it didn't make any sense at all. But it makes a lot of sense now looking back. I was born in the jungles of Venezuela to Dutch parents. I'm Dutch, but I was born in Venezuela. And in my 30s, I went back to see where I was born, which was at the time that I was there in 1958, was a little Indian village. And they were just starting to put encampments, oil encampments, Esso, Exxon, Shell, you name it, all the companies were coming in and drilling for oil. And the story that I grew up with was that it was a little small Indian town and my parents lived there and they worked from the outside for the different oil encampments. My mother was a midwife and my father sold bolt bearings. And then when I was 30, I went back And I was shocked to find the jungle completely wiped out. And this town that was a village with huts, an Indian village, was a city of 1 million people. And the jungle was gone. It was freeways and, you know, houses and cars and all kinds of stuff. Anyway, I was sad about that, but that left an impression. It left a huge impression. Mm-hmm. So my other part of my life is that I rode horses and competed internationally for 27 years. Rode in the World Championships in Sweden and the Pan American Games. And that was a huge part of my life. That influenced, because I realized that when we train animals, any animal, we're imprinting a new way of being in the world.
We're on the horse.
On a horse, on a dog, even if you're training a dog, any animal that you train, that you're...
Can I just ask something? Does it imprint anything on you?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
New imprint too. And it's a form of communication, which is great, but it is also changing the animal.
And your particular sport was dressage. So
yes.
Isn't that highly structured?
It's very, very structured.
Like
it's
the most,
very
yeah.
methodical, structured. It's like dancing. It's very much like dancing.
Yeah. Okay.
So that informed me. And then my parents moved around a lot when I was growing up, and to different countries. So I'm Dutch, we went to Colombia, we went to different places. So I had all these different cultures in me, and one culture was very different than another. But I had to learn to survive in each one of these cultures. That was another piece that put this whole picture together. So there's all these pieces, sections of my life that come together. So when the whole climate change became an awareness, and, you know, the disasters and all that, I wanted to do something that was proactive, that was healing for the earth, not, you know, that I could do something that was healing. So that I could do my little tiny part. Figuring there's a Dutch saying, you know, if you want to change the world, start with yourself. So I was going to do what I could do, you know, whatever that was going to be. So we bought the ranch.
Right.
So being an immigrant and having different cultures, those are different imprints of how to be in the world. Cultural imprints. Training animals are cultural imprints. You come with that. So when we bought the ranch, we decided to buy a ranch and live out in the country. And I learned about regenerative agriculture and, how to do that. When I found out that there were these special cattle that would fit perfectly in the environment that we live in, it made perfect sense to me, because they were bred for a certain environment. And we were taking them from that environment to this environment, which was very much like the environment they were used to. Having been an immigrant, making a change, it's doable. I'm not saying it's not doable, but it is hard. It's really, really hard. It's stressful.
And are you saying that if you take one who was raised or acclimated to one culture or one climate, moving them at least to a similar climate is less stressful on
yes.
that person
yeah.
or animal?
And
is
you'll
it human
see
and animal?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
And you can acculturate. It takes years. It takes generations to acculturate. You can acculturate, but you will always have that little piece where the original landscape that you are most comfortable in. And you'll see that. I mean, the Spanish went to California. If you look to the south of Spain, it looks just like California. The Swedes went to Minnesota. If you look to Minnesota and you look to Sweden, you know, it makes sense.
Ooh, that just gave me a chill.
Yeah, it makes sense that's what people, you know, if they have a choice, they gravitate towards that. And then you can even see it. If somebody is very, very different, then you have this like, wow, they're different. What are they doing?
Well, can I interrupt for one sec? Because you skipped the fact that you got a PhD in somatic psychology.
Yes.
That is fascinating. And I think in that topic, what we've discussed, you get very deeply into that.
Yes.
And code switching, but also just all kinds of adaptation. And we're talking about mostly humans. I didn't read your dissertation, but I'd like to. But that's mostly the human cultural experience.
Yeah, it's the human cultural experience. And what I did was I did research on the body memory. So your sensory memory of what your experience was and when your body just settles and goes, oh, this feels so like home. This feels, I know this, you know, this is easy. Instead of like, oh, I can do this, but, you know, it's hard. I have to think about it. I have to,
There's that switch factor that you have to kind of go, oh yeah, that's food. It doesn't smell like the food I grew up with.
Exactly.
This doesn't feel like the things I used to be in. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Music, huge. sensory parts, you know, if the place is rainy or dry or humid, all that is very much part. Dogs barking in the street, you know, because a lot of island places or third world countries, there's dogs barking all the time. And that is a form of, oh, I know what that is. That's okay. And somebody else would go, oh my God, these dogs are driving me nuts.
Right, right.
Yeah.
So what normal ambient sound would be. So that's for us humans, all those senses. But what you're suggesting, though, is you did some research into what kind of cattle would be most adapted to the environment here.
Exactly. So when these cattle came to me through a consultant and he was talking about it, I went, that makes so much sense. Mm-hmm. These cattle are going to be comfortable here. They're going to be at ease because mm-hmm. their environment is the same and it's going to be mm-hmm. easy. The acculturation is going to be easy. Piece of cake. They have things that are specifically for this dry 9 months of no rain climate. They can eat brush and they can eat grass. So in the dry season, the brush stays green, but the grass goes yellow, so it loses its nutrition. So they still can get a lot of nutrition because they can browse on the brush. So they still stay healthier. And so many little things.
So you had this whole big life and then you moved out to this ranch in, I call it Los Alamos.
Yes.
And you thought you were just going to retire and hang
right.
out.
Yes.
But then a mutual friend of ours, who's a smarty pants, told you, oh no, you may not just rest on that. You better get engaged. So it evolved into several practices that I do want to hear more about, but name the kind of cattle that you have landed on, what they're called and where they're from and what's special about them in terms of climate and regeneration, regenerative practice.
They're called Bonsmaras and they're from South Africa and they started breeding them in the 30s. Professor Bonsma, and he wanted to breed a cow. He wanted to mix the cows because the South African Afrikaner Sanga breed is very, very hardy, but the meat is not that good. And the milk production is you know, it's okay, but it's not that great. So he combined them with Herford and Shorthorn and came up with the Bonsmara breed, which has the hardiness of the Afrikaner, you know, eating brush, staying, you know, healthy with very little nutrition and so on. It has the beef quality of the Herford, and it has the milk quality of the Shorthorn. And it's a super hardy animal, and the beef is really beautiful. It's a beef cattle, which is not my favorite, but it's nature. You can't, it's a yin-yang world. And we breed them. We have just a few cows. We breed them. We have give them a long life. And then we harvest them at not at 18 months, but more like 5 or 6 years. Actually, the meat quality is better the older the cow. It actually is more tender.
That's interesting. And I've heard that, but I don't know what that means. So Let's back up again, because I know I've heard of grass-fed beef and then grass-finished beef. And then I know that how beef is processed is a thing. Can you unpack that a little bit?
So the grass-fed is they go out in the field and they eat grass. And most cows are born on grass, and then at about weaning, they get sent to a feedlot in conventional practices. And then at 18 months, they get harvested. That's an average normal life of a steer. Mm-hmm. And what grass-fed means that by USDA standards, it should be having grass its whole entire life. But a lot of times, the last 3 months of its life, it ends up going to a feedlot and gets fattened for the last 3 months. Again, because the fat ratio in a feedlot, it goes much faster. You get a really fat cow really fast. In 3 months, you can get a fat cow.
Which is good for profit, would you say?
It is very good for profit. It's terrible for your health. And it's, because that's where the beef gets a bad rap with the cholesterol and all that.
I did not know that. I thought there was methane gas because they can't digest the grain. Is there?
They cannot digest the grains, but it fattens them. It's like sending a kid to the candy store and giving him all the candy he could possibly eat. They're going to get fat. But are they going to be healthy?
Yeah. So grass finished beef is actually a cleaner, healthier food.
That's what you're looking for, grass-fed, grass-finished.
And it's better for the environment because they're not having to digest indigestibles and create methane gas, which is one of the top greenhouse gases.
And they're all in a feedlot. They're all in one giant feedlot. And if you were to take all the cattle that are in the feedlots right now and put them on grass, you would have to have all of the United States as a grass field, and then you would still have to import. The amount of beef that we consume is absolutely huge in the United States.
Mm-hmm. I did not know that.
Yeah.
So, is any of it wasted, or is it one of our exports, or is it just Americans are eating that much beef?
Americans are eating that. We import from Brazil. We import from all over. Wow. New Zealand. Australia, there's beef from all over coming in. The amount of beef we eat is enormous. It's enormous.
Now, knowing you, you know probably all the health benefits of how much red meat, and let's just say beef. Is there a guideline you could give us based on all of your knowledge and information? Like if you're eating the right kind of beef, what's recommended?
Well, if you eat grass-fed beef, just in general grass-fed beef, the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6, so omega-6 is your cholesterol, your heavy fats, and omega-3 is more like your salmons. It's a lighter fat, and it's much healthier for you. So the ratio should be 2-1, more or less, on a conventionally fed cow or a feedlot cow, it can be up to 9-12:1 on the six, on the omega sixes to omega-3 ratio. So that's where you get your fatty stuff. Your grass-fed beef is much leaner, and your grass-fed beef is more flavorful because it has the flavor of the earth. And beef is like wine. It should be like wine. The land that the cows are on will give it the flavor, you know, what they're eating and so on.
What flavor are you putting in your beef? What flavor?
Oh, all the stuff that we have. And it has a lovely, lovely flavor. When you taste it, it's like, wow, this tastes like beef. You know, it tastes like beef. It doesn't taste like fat. It doesn't taste like, you know, it tastes like beef. So you got to remember, feedlots only started in the 1960s. So before before that, it was all grass fed. Late 50s, 60s is when the feedlot started. And that's when the palate changed to the more fatty beef, because now it is liked I mean, it's coveted to have fatty beef.
Marbling.
Yes.
Is marbling what we're talking
marbling,
about?
Yes.
And so Bonsmara does not have as much marbling. What type of meat is it comparable to in terms of grocery store meat, in terms of fat?
The grass-fed. Just go for grass-fed, grass-finished beef, and you will have a different kind of beef. It'll taste different. It'll be a different kind of beef. It's really a lot different than... It has a flavor. You can taste the earth. So at first, you know, you go, wow, this is really good, but it's different.
It may be an acquired taste.
It's not acquired because it's good. It's good. It's really, really good. It's not acquired, but it is just like, wow. You know, if you go to Argentina, it's fantastic beef. It's all grass-fed. You know, if you go to Brazil, it's all grass-fed. Now that's a point. Yeah, I mean, they have tons of jungles that they're cutting down to put cattle on it. Again, the whole balance is wrong there. Jungles are for monkeys and birds and so on. They're not for cattle, raising cattle. We want to preserve the fauna of the jungle. Let's raise cattle in country that is cattle country. Let's not change things because there's a cost. There's a cost.
Right. So there's a big, big equation here globally around beef, cattle, how they're raised, how they're the health benefits. I mean, there's a lot of factors in the climate impact. So there's a lot of things you are impacting by taking the land that you decided to move to. What were your first moves and what told you to do cattle and how did that all go? And what, you know, all
the
that?
Cattle was strictly for the land. And then we had to figure out what are we going to do with the cattle? Because if they breed and they have more and more babies and more babies. So what are you going to do?
So tell me what you mean by you got the cattle for the land. Tell me more about that.
Because these particular cattle, they still have their natural instincts. They're not so domesticated and dumbed down. They still have their natural instincts. So they move in a herd. They move in a tight herd. They do that in Africa because if there comes a tiger or a lion and they're all bunched together, the lion is going to go, I'm not going in there. That's a big old bunch of animals. Maybe I'll just catch something little and, not so scary. So they move in a herd. If they move in a herd, which they do, they poop and pee huge areas. They just fertilize the ground like crazy as they move. And the fertilization comes close together. So if you have cow urine, for example, if you have it every 11 feet, then you can have the mycorrhizae starting to connect with each other.
And that's the mushrooms, the fungus layer?
Yeah, the fungus. So it has a tremendous benefit for them to move together. And usually when you see in Africa or in wherever, you know, where they have herds of animals, it's a herd of animal that goes through all together. And they fertilize and break up the land and make it all yummy for the next season. And then they go off and then the rains come and everything comes up again. That's nature's natural rhythm.
Now, I learned a little bit about this by Alan Savory's TED Talk and his book on holistic. And is that what brought you to it? You shared Roger Savory, who we both love, with me. That's what helped me learn about holistic land management. Is that where you learned about this method of being with the land? So the land needs to be disturbed and it needs interaction with other species, which we used to have through migrating animals. Now we have fences and freeways, so we don't have that anymore. So what you're trying to do is introduce a more natural behavior to the land, because when we do the behavior rethink, which is like, well, you stick them out on a pasture and you plant them there and then leave them alone, that actually doesn't do the same thing.
No, it doesn't at all. It doesn't at all.
Right.
And the reason, the reason why it is so bad is if you leave them there all year, you have a huge pasture. Let's say you have, 50 acres and there is 20 cows in there and you leave them in there. when the dry season comes, they're going to be choosing what is green still, which would be the perennial grasses. The grasses, perennial grasses, are grasses that stay green all year round because they have roots that go 20 feet into the ground or more, and they can get water. So they'll be eating all the perennials up because that's what there is. And the perennials will die down, which is what has happened pretty much. There is very few perennials. And so when you bring back the natural way of grazing what animals will do in nature, you are on there, like our animals are on a pasture for 9 days at the most, and then it gets a year rest. All the plants can come up.
A year?
Uh-huh. A year rest.
9 days and then a year of rest?
Mm-hmm.
And do you have smaller sections, would you say?
We have bigger sections, and then we put it in smaller sections so that we can move them from here to here to here. And then, you know, that comes, and that would be their forage. That would be their, you know, and it's rich, and there's all kinds of things popping up now that we hadn't seen before. And all this, we spent, I think Roger spent like 4 or 6 months with us every day coming, teaching us all about cows and regenerative grazing and all that every day out there, you know, learning how to do this. And he was instrumental in, you know, mm-hmm. the design and everything about it. And then he introduced us to many other people that are, you know, champions in the regenerative field, like Alejandro Carrillo, who is greening the desert in the Chihuahuan desert. And it's a completely different landscape from, you know, 30 years ago when he started. So it's really exciting. And it's really the thing that I love the most about it is that it makes so much sense when you actually really think about it, and not just think about the profit, but think about the holistic benefit.
Right. Because actually what you've done then is converted your acreage to actually healthy, thriving, mm-hmm. and therefore carbon sequestering
yes.
land. And you're sinking more water
yes.
and rainwater. When the rainwater does come, it sinks and stays.
Yeah. Yep.
So there's this whole cycle that you've started on your land. Yep. How long have you guys been there, and are you noticing a difference?
Yes, we are definitely noticing a difference. We bought in 17, and the first 20 cattle arrived in the end of 2019. But then we didn't have our bigger herd until 21. And we had to build infrastructure from 2019 to 2021, 22.
So when I think about a cattle farm, I think about, you know, a bunch of fences and dividing the land up. But how do you guys do this?
Well, we use electric fencing, and most of the fences get put up when the cattle are there and then taken down again so that the land is open. We have some bigger pastures that we have fenced in, and that those fences are KiwiTech from New Zealand. And it is a technology where the fence can come down if a wildlife comes through and like a deer jumps it or something and hits it, it won't hurt them. It just folds over and then stands up again. So it's very pliable.
Wow.
So it's made for wildlife. And so those are the permanent fences. They're very, you can hardly see them. And on the 1,000 acres, there's 32 of those pastures, each one about 30 to 40 acres. And then within those 30 and 40 acres, we put in step-ins, is what you call them, where the guys walk and they step it in and put smaller ones to move the cattle around. And then they go to another pasture. Like this morning, they went from one end of the ranch all the way to the other end, which is always so much fun because the horses and the cattle are like, oh, we're going on an outing. And they're all bucking and playing and like, oh, we're going to the other side.
But they won't go back to the place they were for a year is what you're saying.
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay. I can't do the math, but I'm going to assume that all adds up, you know,
yep.
That seems like a lot of sections, but I guess, what did you just say, 35?
Yeah, it's a lot of sections. Within that 35, you have another, at least another 20, probably 30 sections. So you're dividing those up.
Again. I see. Okay. That starts to make sense then. Okay. I got it. I love the idea of this wildlife fencing that allows the wildlife to move through, because even on an avocado ranch, we have that normal cyclone fencing between us and our neighbor. And I'm thinking, I don't really want that.
Yeah. The barbed wire fence is super hard on animals. There's things you can do, which we did before we had the electric fence. There is like a rubber, a plastic tube that you can put on the barbed wire so they can go through it and not get themselves cut. Because barbed wire is really popular fencing. Oh.
Well, we just have that regular, what we think of as chain link. It's not barbed wire, but it's chain link, but it's a barrier, and it would make the deer or the only guy that we're wishing to keep out lately is Cinnamon the Bear, but, you know, because he's been wreaking havoc, but God bless, you know.
Yeah.
But in general, I would be interested in something that would allow the natural diversity and the thoroughfare to just be reestablished. So I love that idea.
And it's and that's a big movement to do fairways for animals to be able to move from one place to the next. The land trust does great work with connecting conserved land so that animals can move and that they have their natural habitat, which is lovely.
And that's the Santa Barbara Land Trust?
Yes.
And I did hear about that there's a movement toward, you know, for those who haven't heard about it, about having freeway crossings.
Yes. There's one in Agoura that they're building. Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love it. Well, so you've mentioned some names, and these are big names. These are hot shots in this rarefied world of regenerative agriculture and land management, holistic land management. But I now know enough to be fangirl and a lot of the people that you talk to. But you've established a foundation that supports education. Tell us a little bit about that foundation and what you guys are up to.
So what we enjoyed learning so much from Roger and Alejandra and other people that are in the industry, there's so many of them, that we wanted to bring that to our community. There is so much stuff out there that is just amazing. So we started the foundation so that we could bring these people here and have workshops for ranchers, students, university students, high school students. We had that with them too. And so that they could be exposed to what is happening in other parts of the world and how these people are going about it, and how their success has served them. And the foundation gives out scholarships to kids and to ranchers that can't afford it, because a lot of ranchers are hand to mouth, especially the cattle business. They're rich in land and not a lot of cash, to expose them to it, that it is possible and that change is possible. And so that's why we want to bring these people, because we learned incredibly fast by being exposed to people that really knew what they were doing. And it made total sense. Everything was like, oh, that makes sense. This makes sense. Well, yeah. So we wanted that experience for anybody else that is interested in it. Mm-hmm. And so we started the foundation, and this year we're going to have 3 speakers. We're talking to Nicole Masters and with the other ones, 2 people from Australia who are super permaculturists, really famous in Australia.
Can you think of their names? Because I'm reading Call of the Reed Warbler right now.
Ah.
Do you know that one?
Yes, I do. Yes. Who wrote that?
Oh, I forget.
Anyway.
I can figure it out, but it's really a good one.
It's Costa, and he is a famous TV person, but he has tons of background on permaculture, and he teaches kids, little kids, and he does these natural pools that are just gorgeous. anyway, he does a lot of stuff. Because I want to do the younger kids too, because looking at the world a whole different way. It isn't about farming the conventional way where they till and they have four crops a year and so on. It's about finding out what the universe under our feet is like, and that there is a whole world out down there, and it's magic. It's magic down there. And so I want to give that to the kids and let them, you know, be aware of that. It's not just dirt.
That education piece. So I know that education is, I mean, what I failed to mention earlier is you and I met when our children were in kindergarten.
That's right. Yes.
And between us, we have some unique learners and a whole, you know, smorgasbord, as one does, of different types of learning. But this idea of teaching young people about nature cycles is just brilliant. And it's what my research absolutely, you know, pointed to.
And I love that. I love finding out all these, you know, about nematodes and yeah, it just, there's so much stuff down there, and it works so, together so beautifully when it's in balance. It just, it just is so magical when it's all in balance. It's really fun. That makes it fun.
Well, I'm definitely going to put information in the notes so that people can get in touch with the foundation, as well as how to order meat. But I wanted to ask you about another kind of unusual thing, which ties back to your history and then it has a unique twist. And that is, you've got a special group of horses on your property.
I do. Well, my passion has shifted from riding horses, which I did for 27 years, to the wild horses and the plight that the wild horses have. A lot of them are being rounded up and taking off the land, off the land management, the Bureau of Land Management land, because the cattle people don't feel there is enough forage. And there's thousands and thousands of horses, wild Mustangs from the Spanish days, that have DNA that is exceptional. And from the Indians, you know, Appaloosas and paints and all kinds of really, really incredible DNA that is still out there. That is the history of the horse in the American West. Anyway, they're being rounded up.
Wow.
They're being sent to Mexico and Canada and so on. And they're sitting in pens now. When they were free horses, now they're jailed in pens. And it's a problem. It's like a huge problem. Anyway, you can adopt them. People adopt them. And we adopted 7. And they run free with the cattle. And it's really fun to see them out on the land. I love it. And to really get to know a wild horse and how intelligent they are and how they have a social life that is so intricate and tight. It's just beautiful to see them, to see the horses in nature and doing their thing and working with them to be at their best. Not for performance, but just for looking at nature, going how magnificent nature is.
And I just think you, more than anyone else I know, probably have a deeper appreciation and impact for that difference between when you were so finely tuned training with a horse and performing a structure and then having wild horses. Can you say anything more about that? Like, how do you feel about that? Do you have an opinion about horse events or how do you talk about it?
I was when I was very young when I started loving horses, and then, you know, that what you do with horses is you show or you play polo or you do something with them. You do something with them because they're in a small stall or in a corral, and then you have to take them out to do something with them. And that's the relationship you build. And for me, what I came out with is that I loved the horses and I loved the riding. But it was very much ego-oriented. It was a competition, who was the best, and so on. And for me, I loved being with the horse. I loved, grooming the horse. I loved going out on a walk. I loved all that, which I did also. But in order to be a good horseman, you had to get, you know, better and better and better and be very competitive, which I did, and I was successful at it. It is a very different relationship. This is just pure joy. I mean, I look out my window and I don't see them. It's because they're way the hell in the backcountry. Or if I see them coming up, it is such joy. Or if I go up and I sit and wait and they come toward me because they're interested. Who are you? You know, oh, it's you again. It's a conversation. It's just so different. And, you know, they play with my hair, or, you know, they sniff my arm, or, you know, they talk to each other and they all have to come and see. Yeah. And it's such a different relationship, and it's such a beautiful relationship. And the intelligence of, they know what they can eat and what they can't eat. You put them out there, there's poisonous stuff, there's all kinds of stuff. They know, they take care of themselves.
Would a highly domesticated horse not have the wisdom anymore?
Mm-mm. No.
Okay.
No, you're constantly looking at the pastures, make sure that nothing is bad, looking at the hay. They colic, they get sick, they get injuries from being locked up and then working hard and locked up again and working hard. Even if they're in a pasture for a couple of hours a day, you know, it's hard. They lose the intelligence of being out in nature. And there is a lot of intelligence to be had.
I cannot help but feel like an extreme parallel with the way we educate our humans.
Yeah.
And the way we educate out that natural connection, that wisdom that we're all born with. I call it like the indigenous child is born connected to the natural environment. And slowly but surely we're like, no, that's not the thing. This is the thing. So the human made matrix of information replaces wisdom. And wow, that's a big deal.
Completely.
That drives it home.
Yeah, I totally and completely agree. That is so true. That is so, so true.
And technically, they're another form of animal that should be roaming, and they also have benefit to the land, would you say?
That's why we have them. There is about 30% more weight gain on a cow when they have other species or horses grazing with them. There is a study, and I forget where, but there is a study out. And so the horses can eat stuff, they can bite it off. Cows use their tongue to grab it and pull it. So they eat different things. They don't eat each other's food that much.
Oh.
They eat different stuff. So they actually complement each other. And cattle move a lot more if the horses are there. The horses go at a faster speed and they are more playful. Cattle are very relaxed and slow, but they will stay with the horses more and they'll explore more. Yeah, it's a very different relationship.
Well, so if you had pigs, would that add more goodness?
Yeah.
Sheep? I mean, are you supposed to mix everybody up, or is there a limit to that?
You can. And the chickens, when the animals come down to the irrigated pastures and we put the chickens with them, the animals love the chickens. They're all like, oh, hi. You know, it's like a party. It's they like it. And you can have the pigs. The pigs do very different things. They would be more in the trees. They would be more, you know, eating. And each one serves a purpose. And you can either have them where they go one behind each other, or you can have them where, you know, they all sort of go together. And they get used to each other.
Well, I just have to say, you know this, but I have almost every day I think about what livestock I can have on this land. We've had sheep, we had our own tiny flock, then we rented sheep last year, and it just, the land felt happier. I don't know, that may sound crazy to some people, but the land and even the people who work here, everybody was just happier. So I know we need animals, but right now, I mean, we have chickens, but they have very limited run. And so I think I'm going to need you to help hold my hand, because I see it as like this big move to get livestock out here of any kind. So what do you say to somebody like me? Do I have to understand a whole lot of science before I bring two of your cows out here?
No, you don't have to know a lot of science, but you do have to have the ability to move the animals either with fencing or that they actually are moving and not coming back to a certain spot so that the grass can grow. Great if you have rangeland that needs, that has brush or whatever, they're great for cleaning that up. Other thing is donkeys. They're fantastic, and there is lots of wild donkeys. They're great animals for eating all kinds of stuff. They're
like chaparral. We have some chaparral. I don't have like open range, but we do have chaparral, or we have patches of area that could be considered grazing.
Yeah. So the chaparral is great. They'll trample it, get it all back into the earth. And then the following year you come and you see and you go, wow, look at that. And all kinds of good stuff comes up. So you could have a combination of animals, you could have two horses, a burro, two cows, and you can sort of pick and choose and just sort of let them get acclimatized to each other and have them move together. And but you'd have to move them in order for it to work. You have to move them. You have to have water, which, is a thing. How hilly is it? Is it easy to put in the fences and so on? Our land is extremely hilly, very, very hilly. So those things have to be taken into consideration. And then you have to decide whether you're going to keep them as your pets or whether, the circle of life is going to be happening.
Right. So is that a hard shift for you? Because you guys decided to do meat.
It was not our preference. We were going to do bulls, but that's way down the line. Because first you have to get the breed recognizable before people start buying bulls and so on. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we shifted to meat. The way we made peace with it is we do older cows. And actually, it's a huge thing in Italy and in Spain to do vaca vieja, which means old cow. The meat is much more tender and it's much more flavorful. So the cow can have a long life. And and the steers, we do them at 3 years instead of 1.5 years. So the meat is a very premium product. Mm-hmm. And we really think about what we're doing and what's the best for everything, the land, the economics, the cattle themselves, all things are taken into consideration when a decision is made. And the whole point of the matter is it's not mass production. It is, we know these cows, we've seen them being born, we love them, they know us and so on. And it's the circle of life. And it's, if we don't do that, if we don't have the harvesting, it's like people not dying. It's like, animals not dying.
Well, and what I hear is that you're addressing a whole number of issues. You're creating food that's actually healthier for the consumer. You're giving the cow a good life.
Yes.
You're treating the land well, and so that it is healthier in itself. Right. And as a result of that, you're also sequestering more carbon. So you're actually on a couple of different levels producing beef while reducing dangerous climate effects. I'm hearing that you're hitting a lot of notes right here. Okay, there's a term. See, everything has to be a euphemism in this whole meat area. There's a term called processing, or what do you call that part of it? And is that particular? I remember hearing a lecture from a woman named Temple Grandin, and I understood there's a whole science there. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yes. So first of all, there is processing and there is harvesting. Harvesting is where they actually get killed. Uh-huh. And you want to have it close to where they live so that they're not driving miles and miles and miles to go. Mm-hmm. And then they arrive and they have to have a rest place where they can mellow out. Again, when we do our cows, we only send two or three at a time. So they're going with their buddies, and they are in a rest place. We hear from the processing place, the harvesting place. They call us, tell us how they've arrived. Okay, they're good. Everybody's mellow. Everybody's calm. And then they spend the night, and then early the next morning, they get harvested. They don't even really know that they're going through, because they go through a chute all through their life. Since they're babies, they go through a chute for whatever it is that we're doing. If we're inseminating, or if they need their shots for vaccination, or if they get hurt and we need to do something. Actually, we don't vaccinate anymore. We used to vaccinate. If they get, because it's a closed herd, there's no other animals from the outside coming in. So
you don't need to vaccinate is what you're saying.
Not really. It's all closed. It's all, it's our land. It's our animals. It's, so they are completely at ease going in the chute and out of the chute. It's not a big deal. They do that at least two or three times a year, and they've done it since birth. So it's like, oh, okay, we're going through the chute. So by the time they get harvested, they go through the chute. It's like another chute. They don't even know, and it happens instantly. So they're immediately dead. So that part, again, is about handling the cattle in a way that it is not traumatic. There is no yahooing, there is no mooing, there is no nothing. It's just, oh, okay, we're doing this, all right, And they're completely at ease. They have a full tummy, they have a nice drink, some food before the night before, and it's like going under for a surgery,
Right.
Like, oh, okay.
It's like you have a really good meal. Yeah. Well, okay, so it seems to me that perhaps there's a couple reasons. One is it's humane to the animal,
yes,
to not have fear and discomfort and being treated like a piece of meat,
right?
Which they're becoming. But also, have I heard that if there are stress hormones in the animal, that does impact when you eat it? Does that have
the
some impact?
It's different. Yes. The flavor, you can taste it in the meat if you are very, very skilled at eating, tasting the stress hormones. Yes, you can taste it. So you want to have them. There's a couple of things. Stress is very, very big on, you need a lot more fat to hide the flavor of the stress.
Wow. Okay. This is a whole thing. I don't know any of this. Most people do not know. And what I see is, how wine tasting has just really taken off?
Yes.
It seems like we could go there.
Exactly. Totally. It is just like wine tasting. It's the terroir. It's the soil. Because that's what you're eating, in a different form. Whether the cattle can stay, whether they don't have the very big skinnying. So like if you look at the cows, they get incredibly skinny in California in the dry season. And then they start gaining weight in the wet season, and then they get incredibly skinny. That ballooning and skinnying up, that actually is stress also. They're stressed out.
Right.
It doesn't matter in the end product if you're going to a feedlot, because you can fatten them up and they'll taste wonderful. But if you're doing grass fed, you want to keep them at a good, nice weight consistently, because you will taste the meat, and the meat will taste like stress if it isn't covered in fat.
Now, is this a new product on the market? Because, Wagyu beef was introduced, to my knowledge, it came to my awareness not that long ago. I don't even know what that means. All I know is it costs more. Like a lot more. Is this something that could get introduced into the broader market, or is it going to be a specialty food, do you think?
It's a specialty food in Japan. Nobody eats the quantity of meat that we do. The McDonald's and the Burger Kings and the amount of meat that Americans eat is enormous. Good for them. Wonderful. but it is really, really huge. And so it is not the Wagyu, the proper Wagyu in Japan, is a very small number of cattle, and they have a special gene. And then there is different, I think there's five different Wagyu breeds, but the very expensive Wagyu, they get special treatment. It's kind of, you know, they feed them sake and all kinds of stuff. They are fat, but they have a fat marbling. It's a gene that they have, that they have a fat marbling that they can carry more fat, and they have more omegas is what is said. I don't know if it is true or not, but it's very, very tender. It's very, and you eat very, I mean, they give you a piece like this big.
Right. I've noticed.
You know, and that tells you something.
It's good. I mean, I noticed the difference.
It's great. And but that tells you, this is how much you need to eat. It's not massive amounts.
If it's done right, if it's done well, and if it's done healthy on all, for all levels of existence, then we're going to have it in a smaller quantity and be just fine.
Yeah.
Now, is it still possible to get some of your beef? I mean, how would I go about that?
Yes, we are on the website. You can order it. You can either pick it up at the ranch, or deliveries over $300 are, there is release on Wednesdays in Santa Barbara and Montecito. It gets delivered.
So it's really a local product right now.
It's very local. It will always be a very local product.
Okay, so that's part of the program here. Yeah. I get it, yeah, which I get. But if we can get, I mean, are you seeking to inform others about this practice and about this type of cattle? Yes.
Definitely, okay. And definitely about the cattle, definitely about the practices. And more ranches, more, you know, more land being regenerated. I mean, the special thing about this cattle is that they are very, very good at regenerating the land, because they stay together and go in a tight herd, because they, that which is huge, because they go up and down mountains, because they browse and graze. They have so many qualities that are really important in this environment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Plus they're cute.
They are cute. They're very cute.
Right. They're cute. Well, I just so appreciate your whole lens. I mean, I know that we could get off on all kinds of subjects around, you know, spirituality and health and parenting and education and all the things. And your general mindset has always been holistic and life promoting rather than life negating. And for that, I really appreciate you.
Thanks.
What would you like listeners to take away? I mean, there's so much great information here, but can you say like what you would love for everybody to walk away having a feeling of, or some direct message you want to share?
The feeling that I would want listeners to walk away with is that there is so much wisdom in nature that we are negating. And if we just walk away from putting ourselves first and just really, really listen to the wisdom that nature has to offer, it is such an incredible world. It's so, so cool. It doesn't make the profits that the regular world makes, but it makes happiness in tenfold. It just is magical.
That's beautiful. Well, thank you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
We'll do more.
Thank you. And it's so fun talking with you. And I love everything you do.
That's a wrap for today's episode of Regenerative Spaces. If you found this episode valuable or thought-provoking, share it with a friend and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. We'll keep the conversation going over on Instagram, so join me at Stacy Pellice, and share your thoughts, questions, or suggestions for future episodes. I love hearing from you. And before we go, your support means the world to me. If you have a moment, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help us reach even more people looking to spark sustainable change in our world. Stay curious, stay inspired, and until next time, this is Stacey Pollice, and you've been listening to Regenerative Spaces.